Welcome back to Homegrown. I remain Bob Hill.
And this is Janine Wishing.
And today we continue a show we began last week with the plastic pots problem in this nation. What to do with all these black pots that
all the gardeners... The not-so-green part of the green industry.
Right.
Yeah, last week we talked about sort of a standardization of just size and shape so that everybody would have the same thing. They could be reused. Platt Hill even... I think they do some like deposit and recycle or turning back in. So like at the end of the season, you turn yours back in and then you get, you know, this exchange thing. But he also stressed that this was not the solution, just one part of it, and recycling being another, and then also coming up with good biodegradable materials to make pots so we don't have so much plastic. So as Bob said, we continue along that those lines, and we hit the recycling program at Missouri Botanical Garden.
Dr. Steve Klein, it's a great program. They've recycled in 10 years 335 tons of plastic pots and cell pots and that thin stuff they use for packaging and, you know, put it back in the market again, reusing it. So it's a leader in the country, really, on the...
They've worked out the kinks over the last 10 years.
The whole
St.
Louis
so we'll
area
mm-hmm.
literally dumps into the program.
Yeah, so we'll find out the details about that. And then we're also going to talk with someone from Ball Seed Company. They're working on biodegradable types of materials for their pots.
Yeah, I heard them give a talk here at a nursery show here in Louisville a couple of years ago. Well, a man named Greg Trapka on there. He's the head of that program. They use all sorts of stuff, including chicken feathers.
I know,
I'm not sure
fabulous.
Ball's using chicken feathers, but...
but that's a material.
That's near and dear to your heart, I'm sure. So you're probably out there fashioning...
I've wondered how long it'll take those chicken feathers that are in the barn from molting to biodegrade, because I think it probably takes a little bit of time.
But it's a great idea, with the problem being, of course, that for a nursery anyway, if you put a plant in there in April and water it every day, is the pot going to rot before you sell the plant? So there's that fine line to deal with in the nursery business, although for the homeowner, buy the plant, put it in the ground.
Exactly.
In the pot.
In the pot. So, just like we used to do with peat pots.
Exactly.
That's right. All right. So we hope that you'll stay with us for Homegrown today. In part two of the show, we're going to speak with Dr. Mark Worms. He's the new executive director of Bernheim Arboretum. He came on in July of last year. So we gave him some time to get his sorts about him here. He came from Los Angeles County to Bullitt County. Pretty good move. We look forward to finding out what his vision is for Bernheim in the years ahead.
I've met him a couple of times. Very enthusiastic man about the job. And as we keep saying about Bernheim, one of the great secrets of this area. It's a great place and not used enough. And
not nearly enough.
Perpetual problem of getting people to go 20 miles. To go see it.
Yeah.
Shouldn't be that hard.
I think that's one of their goals as of late, is to get more people out there.
Exactly.
So we'll find out about that coming up in part two. So we hope that you'll stick around. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
Well, not my garden, but I went to the Sense Nursery Show in Columbus, Ohio recently, and I got fired up in the middle of this lousy January weather. But when you sit there and listen to plant experts talk and you spend hours and hours in a room with other gardeners, see the new plants, see the new cultivars, see the new ideas, it just reinvigorates you. Then you have to come back and sit in the house and suck on your thumb for a while. But and by way of encouraging people to go to seminars, join a garden club, get involved. Don't just sit in your house and read catalogs. And you all can get through this together. You kind of hold hands and sing Kumbaya or something. But anyway, I just love being around gardeners, and other people should feel the same way.
Yeah.
How about the wish you stay? What's up?
Well, again, not in the garden either, but something from the garden. I'm surprised I do not see more snakes in my basement, live snakes.
Are they mating or otherwise?
Because this is the second time that I have found a snake skin
My wife's
hanging
not listening.
In my utility room.
Yeah, we've done that.
So, and like, I can't, for the life of me, I can't remember the word.
Uck?
No,
yucky?
No. About snakes, like they go back to the same place.
Oh,
they're loyal to their particular place, right? So they always go back there.
Sentimental, maybe.
Well, but there's some term for it. So they always go back to the same place, and we know that we have snakes living, like in a crevice area, sort of between where the cistern's built, off the side of the house, right? And that's exactly how they're getting somehow. I think along the foundation. And molting in our basement. And, you know, I don't mind snakes at all. They would startle me if I went down to pick up the laundry, you know, and there was a snake there underneath my laundry. But I'm surprised that I haven't seen any, and I'm delighted that I haven't seen any, but the snake skin is proof, is it not?
Yeah.
It's actually hanging from a copper pipe.
Well,
that, you know, brings water into the house.
A very confused snake.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'm trying to think of a certain song that would attract snakes or some particular rock group or modern group that would...
I think it's probably the warmth of my basement.
It's not Willie Nelson
it's
or
not
some
music.
Of my old favorites. Or...
Could be.
Oh,
so,
yeah.
Yes, there are snakes in the basement, but fortunately for me, all I see are the skins.
That'd be a name for a rock group.
Snakes in the Basement.
Yeah.
I think that's a good
probably
name.
Probably is one already.
I think that's a good one. All right, there's an event coming up at Thienemann's Herbs and Perennials, February 13th.
Must be spring if Thienemann's is cranking
exactly.
up.
Exactly.
It's got to be.
Friday, February 13th or Saturday, February 14th. Planting your trough garden. Both days it starts at 10 a.m. and you'll be able to create a miniature container, the trough containers that you put little succulents and alpines, miniature conifers, that sort of thing in the container. They'll help you plant it up. So I think they're probably getting geared up for spring as well and trying to get people excited. So here's your opportunity. You can check out our website at wfpl.org for more information on that event and everything else in the show, of course.
And they're also pretty environmentally conscious out there, Thienemann.
They're way environmentally
I know
conscious.
That. Yeah.
And I would say that creating your own trough is probably one of the best containers you could possibly create. But there are other options, to be sure. Recycling's one of them. And as we mentioned, the Missouri Botanical Garden in St. Louis has a fabulous program, 10 years running. Dr. Steve Klein is in charge of it.
He's going to tell us all about it. Dr. Steve Klein is the founder and organizer of Missouri Botanical Garden's Residential Garden Recycling Program, the most extensive in the nation. With a collection of 150,000 pounds of horticultural waste in 2008, the program has now saved more than 670,000 pounds or 335 tons of plastic garden pots, cell packs, and trays from our landfills. He's here to tell us all about it. Steve, welcome to Homegrown.
Thanks, Bob. Good to be with you.
Thank you. Let's have a little background first on the need for the program and how it got started.
Well, plastic pot recycling at the Missouri Botanical Garden got started in 1998, and it really boiled down to something pretty simple, and that is that as I looked in my garage and saw all the gardening containers I had left over, it occurred to me that there's probably a lot of people just like me who keep containers and expect to use them in their gardening practices from year to year, but the fact is that most people accumulate more plastic than they can use. So there is a surplus, and after I checked into it a little bit, didn't take very much to see that over 350 million pounds is generated each year in the U.S., and that amounts to a couple of baseball stadiums full of plastic, and obviously that fills our landfills. So it seemed like there was a need here to try to find a way in which to deal with all this plastic. So it was rather simple to go to the next step, and that was to try to find a way in which to appeal to our membership. We have about 35,000 members at the Missouri Botanical Garden. We thought that'd be a good pilot project. We appealed to them to bring us their plastic, and oh, did they.
So how does the program work once people dump all their extra pots onto you all? Do you all actually recycle them there? Do you send them off to a recycling center? I mean, do you have to sort through them? What are the logistics after all?
There are many logistics, mm-hmm. and it took us kind of 10 years, not that we're slow, but to really work through this process is a little bit complicated. I'll make it sound easy in the end, but we started out with people bringing us pots, and they would just step out of their car and say, here you go. The fact is there's three different types of plastic in horticulture. There's polypropylene, polyethylene, and polystyrene. The styrene are the cell packs and the trays that we're probably mm-hmm. very familiar with.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And because there are three different types of plastic, you can't simply just put them all together and then say, here, take it and make something out of it, because it all has to be melted down if you're recycling. So you have to separate it out. And it took us a while to get to that point because it's fairly labor-intensive. But the answer to that problem came when a couple years ago we were able to purchase through some grant awards it received from our solid waste management district here in the St. Louis area, and also from Monrovia growers who are in California, mm-hmm. and really turned the corner and said, hey, we're the industry. We need to be responsible for this. They allowed us to buy recycling trailers, and these trailers then could be put out at garden centers where when people would go back to buy plants,
yeah, right.
And the simple thing about a trailer is that you can have various compartments. And so if you can get people to read the recycling symbols on the containers, then they can start to separate those out. So at least 85% of our labor dropped at that point when individuals would separate their own material.
Mm-hmm. So, Steve, you know, just as a, at a casual glance, or, you know, as far as I can recall, most nursery pots, plastic pots, don't actually have the recycling symbol on the bottom, do they? Or do they have to have that recycling symbol on the bottom for them to be recyclable?
The answer is, the first part is, most of them actually do have a recycling symbol. The problem is you can't see it.
Okay.
Oftentimes it's buried. It's almost imperceptible, and it doesn't stand out is the problem. That's one of the issues I am kind of preaching about, is those who are making gardening containers could do a better job in that, so that we'd have a recycled product that's a lot easier to identify. But there are recycling symbols on the majority. Now, that goes for the pots. When it comes to the trays and the cell packs, the answer is no. There aren't any recycling symbols typically on those, although if you just recognize a cell pack and a tray, you assume that that's a different kind of plastic, and so it's okay, but I still would prefer that recycling symbols are on everything and they were legible.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Well, Steve, how big an area do you now serve, and what becomes of the plastic you collect?
The area that we focus on is the perimeter, really, around St. Louis, and I suppose we have received shipments from several hundred miles away of people just dying to bring us plastic. It doesn't seem reasonable, quite honestly, so our interest has been to try to develop other satellite areas, or at least encourage people to collect for a period of time and then stack these things together and bring them in. But in an environmental sense, it doesn't make much sense to spend a lot in gasoline or diesel to bring them a long distance.
Right.
So we try to encourage people to set up their own sites. But that's a slow thing to evolve, because the industry has not stepped up totally to the whole business of recycling horticultural plastic. There are some issues with that, and so we're trying to work those things out as we develop a model system that can be used in another community.
Well, do you shred the pots on site or what?
In fact, yes, Bob, we do shred those. Several years into the program, probably 8 years ago, the industry kind of went, I'll say, downhill. It got depressed, and it made it so that we couldn't send the pots, which were not ground at that point, to a processor. We had previous times, and we would pay them actually to process that pot, to grind it up into small chips, which then could be remelted down and incorporated to a product. But at that point, people wouldn't take it because it just wasn't enough money in the whole thing. So we invested in some machinery, which cost quite a bit of money in order to process the material. But the benefit is that we could control that part of the process so that we didn't have to depend upon somebody else and the market going up and down.
Steve, does the St. Louis area have just traditional recycling, you know, curbside home recycling programs? And why is it that just automatically putting, as you get them, putting your nursery pots in your traditional recycling is something that's not done or can't be done or is problematic in some sort of way? I'm a little confused. You know what I mean? I'm a little confused why it's not a part of just the larger scheme of things.
Right. It's a great question. I think the answer is that traditionally we have put them in the trash, and they have gone out. The trash haulers typically, and I'll speak, you know, over the top here because there's lots of different scenarios, but but there are certain types of plastic, like the polystyrene plastic, which would be the cell pack and tray. People do not want to take that material. Mm-hmm. And so they discourage that. Now, they may not come out and say that blatantly, but they may leave it there at your at your trash can and say, we don't take this. The polyethylene and polypropylene, the regular pots, they will take, but it all gets commingled. And the thing is that until that commingling could get separated at a transfer station where you bring a truckload of material in and actually it gets looked at, and then someone says, okay, glass over here, metal over here, until that time, we were just basically throwing it all together. So we were just throwing it out. It has value, but people just pitched it. Now, if you were to go back to your municipality and say, okay, for the trash hauler that works in our city, what is their policy? They'll tell you exactly what plastics they do take and not take.
Right.
What I find is that people still tend to discard it as trash, ends up in a landfill, and we need a better way in which to deal with the material. As long as the individual can separate that out like they would a tin can or a piece of glass, then I think we're better off to try to create more pure sources of that waste and then get it into the right hand so it can be reutilized again.
Well, Steve, after you're done shredding the plastic, do you sell it for a profit to keep the program going or what?
The plastic that's shredded is remarketed, absolutely. So we are getting it back into the market so it can be useful again, and it goes into a variety of products, not necessarily always related to gardening, but we do try to do that. The big emphasis is try to get it back into a product locally so that there isn't heavy transportation costs and you spend a lot of fuel trying to get it someplace where, in a sense, kind of negates the whole business of trying to recycle something.
And have you become a model for other communities now?
It has. It's received a lot of national attention. I think we just gutted it out, basically. It was one of those things where, you know, we had to go through this. We thought there was value. It's the right thing to do. And it has served as a model, and it's been recognized. I'm pleased to say that. But there are a lot of obstacles in it, even when people set up their own site. So I encourage people to give me a call and ask questions about how you do it or send me an email. And it kind of explained the ups and downs of what you have to do to invest in the way in which we did it versus thinking of another way to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks a lot, man. I appreciate it. And we'll check back maybe in a couple of years and see how you're doing.
That'd be great. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Dr. Steve Klein is the founder and organizer of the Missouri Botanical Gardens Residential Garden Recycling Program. For more information on the program, visit the Homegrown page at wfpl.org.
All right, the three R's of...
Recycling.
It's not even that. It's bigger than that. Yeah. Of being green. How about that? Reduce, reuse, and recycle, right?
Gotcha.
Something that is available to us more and more, we're starting to see on the market. I know some stuff that I bought last year came in biodegradable pots made out of rice, I think.
That's it.
So, you know, I think the industry in biodegradable pots is something that we need to start to take notice of as well. And Ball Seed Company has a line that we're going to find out about.
We've got a man named Greg Trapka on the line. He's manager of the EcoPots division of the Ball Seed Company, one of the biggest companies in the world, and it's working on ways to create biodegradable nursery pots. Greg, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, we've discussed the problem with plastic pots on a couple shows and some other guests, and we're curious, what got Ball Seed involved in the biodegradable pots, the Eco Pots?
Well, BioContainer for us is just a part of our sustainable initiative, which we began about 5 years ago. So this is the part which we can do for industry to help it save the environment, use more environmentally friendly products. Mm-hmm.
So, Greg, prior to the EcoPots, did Ball actually have a manufacturing division for, you know, just conventional pots?
No.
Okay.
Actually not. A long time ago, about 15, 20 years ago, we used to own Jiffy Pots. We had some interest in Jiffy Pots, but that was sold. And after that, we only distributed plastic pots for a while.
Okay.
But we did not own any factories.
Okay. So now you all actually control it yourself, which is, in fact, good. Can you talk a little bit about what the options are in the EcoPots? Is it just one biodegradable material, or do you all have, you know, several different options in terms of biodegradable materials?
There's actually several different options. We can start with the LI pot by Ball, which is basically wrap around the soil, so there is no true pot at all there. And then we can go through several fiber type pots. One of the pot which we involve right now in distributing is so-called rice hull pot.
Rice.
Yeah, 80% of the material is rice hulls, which otherwise would be burned on the field and emit quite a bit of CO2, and we actually found a use for the material, and were able to produce the containers for plants.
So did you all come up with the technology then?
We are part of the few companies which develop the technologies and improve the technologies on the ongoing basis.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Greg, you mentioned L-pots earlier. I think it's E-L-L-E. Talk a little more about that and what they were and how they work.
Well, basically, L-pots is a, it's hard to describe. It's a, it's like a plug.
Because
it contains the soil, and mm-hmm. the soil is compressed and it's wrapped with the paper wrap.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And it comes in the trays.
Okay.
So when a grower purchases this, it buys the entire tray with the LI pots mm-hmm. inside.
So that would be something that would be more geared towards a greenhouse grower, and then if the rice hull containers would be something that would be geared more towards the retail end of it, right?
Yes, we've been trying to introduce LI pots to the retail market for several years.
Uh-huh.
It's been slow coming, but in the last couple of years, we're actually seeing the LI pot in the retail. So it's a little bit difficult to sell it in retail because it's a little messy. It has mm-hmm. oil coming out of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, the rice pots is going to be a cleaner option.
Well, we've heard talk about chicken feathers. Is that true for biodegradable pots?
Yes, actually, there's quite a development in chicken. We tried to introduce chicken pot about 5 years.
Uh-huh.
5 years ago.
Yeah. It was a, chicken pots.
It was the old technology. It was basically a compressed chicken feather, which was bind with special binders. But right now, I believe HRI is developing a new technology. It's much cleaner technology, and they're also using the chicken feather to produce it.
Okay.
So most of the ball pots are made out of rice hulls then?
Yes, right now the majority of the ones which we sell is the rice hulls. We are introducing a new line of pots called OP47. It's a French technology. It's a bioresin, 100% renewable material. There's quite a few plant starches used to produce it.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks almost like traditional thermoform pot.
Mm-hmm. So when we look at these different types of pots, some of them have a longer shelf life than others, the L pot being a shorter one and maybe the rice hull one being a longer one. You know, what are the issues in terms of shelf life when it comes to a container? You want it to last just long enough but not too long, right?
Yeah, you definitely want this to last through the growing process and through the retail.
Mm-hmm. So how long do the various pots typically last?
Well, right now, the solutions which we offer last from 6 to 12 months. That depends on the environment mm-hmm. of the greenhouse or the garden centers. And after use, we recommend disposing it in the compost, home compost.
Mm-hmm.
Now, could a gardener take one of these pots home with a plant in it and actually plant the whole pot? Are you recommending that they plant it out like you do plastic pots and then throw away the rice hull pot?
Well, there's two options. The LI pot can be planted directly in the ground.
Okay.
One of the version of the rice pot, which we call net pots,
mm-hmm.
it can be planted directly in the ground. Rest of the net pots, as well as the new OP47 material, we recommend that the gardener removes the plant from the pot and
dispose it
into the compost.
Okay.
But ideally, long range, you'd have a pot that would somehow last exactly long enough that you could just always plant the plant and the pot together. Is that a goal of yours?
Yes, our goal is to have all containers plantable. We call them basically plantable.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So there is no composting process. You just put it in the ground and it decomposes in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
The issue is that material usually decomposes much slower in the ground than in the compost pile.
Okay. Right.
Yeah.
There's just much more microbial activity in the compost. So
right. There
is some technical issue finding and tweaking the material, which would perform adequately in the greenhouse and garden center and then rapidly decompose in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Are most of your rice pots the traditional 1 gallon, or do you actually make them into bigger 5, 10, 20 gallons for bigger shrubs and trees?
Right now we have six sizes. The larger one is 1 gallon.
The largest is 1 gallon.
Yeah.
Okay. So Greg, in terms of cost viability on your end of it and the consumer's end too, I suspect, are you finding that in the long run, once these technologies are developed, that it's going to be more cost effective? Or is it something that is, you know, a little bit more costly, but it's a smarter thing to do in the long run?
Well, it's definitely a smarter thing to do on the long run. When we're talking about the cost, we have to look at the entire life cycle. One thing which you can't just compare it to the price when you buy it. You have to also include the price of the disposal of the plastics or recycling of the plastic.
Right.
So if you take the entire life cycle of the product, the costs, I would say, are comparable.
Okay.
If you just compare the prices. At the moment, the biomaterials are a little bit more expensive.
Mm-hmm. Are you finding at this point a lot of resistance within the industry to these pots? Are they waiting for the perfect pot, or how are things going in that direction?
Actually, there is quite a bit of interest. Our sales are increasing every year. Like with every new technology, you have to find first adapters first, and it takes usually a few years to introduce any product to the market. Mm-hmm. But so far, we're pretty happy with the results.
All right.
Well, Greg, thanks for your time, and this is really kind of something we all need to see in the industry, and I'm glad Ballseed are working on it.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
Bye.
Greg Trapka is manager of the EcoPots division of the Ballseed Company. For more information on EcoPots or Ballseed, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
After the break, Bernheim Arboretum's new executive director, Mark Worms, joins us in the studio. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I'm Bob Hill.
And, of course, Bob and I often talk about what a treasure Bernheim Forest is for this area. Some people absolutely know about it. Some people still don't.
Not enough don't know about it.
That's right. So we have some exciting news for Bernheim recently because they've named a new executive director. And I think, you know, we decided to give Mark a couple months to get his sorts about him. And then we decided to get him on the show.
Yeah, and he showed up anyway.
And he showed up anyway, yeah. But Mark Worms is in the studio with us today. He's Bernheim Arboretum's new executive director as of last July. Before he came to Kentucky, he was the chief executive officer of the Los Angeles County Arboretum and Botanic Garden. Before that, he was at the Kansas City Zoo, and he was also the horticulture director at the Bronx Zoo. Mark has a degree in botany and a PhD in ecology and animal behavior, which I think makes him a perfect fit at Bernheim, where their main objective, of course, is connecting people with nature. Mark, welcome to Homegrown, and thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Great. You do have a great resume when it comes to appreciating and understanding what nature is and how everything that it has to offer, you know, not just specimen plants, but also the other things that are going on. If you can explain your personal philosophy when it comes, I mean, I'm sure it's been shaped by all these experiences you have, but your personal philosophy and how it's going to fit in here at Bernheim Arboretum.
Oh, great. Yes. I've always been a student of nature. I've always been fascinated by the little things, the big things, the things that were under rocks, the water flowing over rocks, and the trees that I could climb. And so I think my personal philosophy is something about getting people as excited about nature as I am.
Okay.
And I find beauty and solace, hope, sometimes just pure fascination and wonderment in nature. Mm-hmm. And so a place like Bernheim with 14,000 acres of beautiful rolling lands and creeks and streams and ponds and arboretum is the perfect place to get people excited. And whether that's excited about this world-class holly collection that's out there, or whether it's excited about a pileated woodpecker.
Right.
I don't really care.
Yeah.
What I want them to do is be excited about being outdoors and being surrounded by such beauty.
All right.
And Mark, I know that Bernheim over the years had different missions, I guess is the word. Some research, some people worried about the native planting, some where you want to see trial gardens. Do you have any sense at this point where you might lead it, what direction that might take, or what mix you might have with that?
Well, I think one of the things that Bernheim has is it has space. And so it can fulfill a lot of different needs for a lot of different people. And whether that's hiking the Millennium Trail, all 13 miles of it, or whether that's coming out with a picnic for your family, we have space to provide those kinds of opportunities. Bernheim has played this give and take between formal horticulture and informal, natural and more exacting. And I think what's going to happen is that as we go into some strategic planning here coming up in the next few months, we're going to find that we want to be more relevant to the community. We want everybody to say, I can come to Bernheim and get ideas for my backyard. I can come to Bernheim and have fun with my grandchildren. I can come to Bernheim and experience nature, whether I'm a poet or an artist or a photographer. I want to be at Bernheim. Mm-hmm. And so I think we're going to still wear many hats. But one of the things that you will see is, I think, a renewed sense of horticulture, where we're going to be adding new and exciting plants to our landscapes. Probably less the old formal way of lining things up and having, you know, 500 hollies in a row. Probably more towards the idea, how do you create beautiful experiences with plants? And how do you create beautiful experiences in a landscape while showing off those individual species and varieties? And so it's going to take kind of a new aesthetic, I think, maybe, mm-hmm. is what we may be leaning towards.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any specific ideas or plans in terms of programs and other things that are entirely new to the Bernheim lineup?
Yes, Janine, we do. And it's wonderful. When you work with a creative staff and board and you say, hey, guys, let's you know, put everything on the table and see what really stands up. It's a pretty wonderful experiment. And that's already happened. At Colorfest in October, we introduced a new program that was called the Scarecrow Jubilee. Mm-hmm. And there we had staff build these wonderful creative scarecrows, the celebrating fall. Well, that program is open for the public to build their own, to enter their own scarecrows.
Oh, wow.
For our next October in, mm-hmm. in Colorfest. Mm-hmm. And those will be on display for a month or 6 weeks. So we're opening up a lot of our programs to the community as a whole. So we want artists and school groups and Boy Scout troops and Girl Scout troops and churches and others all contributing to these things. In the spring, May 16th, we have Bloomfest.
So that's all entirely new.
Brand new. And the idea is to celebrate spring with wildflower walks and garden talks, local experts talking on gardening, perhaps one of you even. wonderful things like kite flying and perhaps creating a giant flower out of messages, mm-hmm. and sending that off to the White House to encourage President Obama to protect natural resources and beauty. Mm-hmm. You know, those are the kinds of things, or, you know, food and music and all kinds of things at Bloomfest. So we do have a lot of new things coming up.
Mm-hmm. Plus, you also have something near and dear to my heart. You have a permanent arts display, I think, in one of the buildings there. You have an artist in residence quite often. Talk about that.
Right. We have a 20-year history with artists in residence at Bernheim. And what's so neat is that they come from all over the world and they bring their eye and their ideas to Bernheim. And we are informed by them and we help inform them as well, because many times it's the first experience for some of these artists to live. They live at Bernheim for 3 to 6 months, and they experience nature in a way they never would have. And so suddenly their art becomes much more organic and giving and influenced by the beauty around them. And so this spring, we're bringing back Yvonne Mullock, who is a wonderful artist from Glasgow, Scotland. And we're bringing her back because she was here last summer and works so well with our staff and the community. And one of the concepts we're playing with has to do with birds. I'm not going to tell you any more than that at this point.
But, just a tease.
But it's one of those things where you're going to say, wow, isn't that something special? And only an artist's mind could create it.
Mm-hmm. Also, kind of a behind-the-scenes part of Bernheim is the research component.
Yes.
You know, the research forest part of,
yes.
of Bernheim. What's going on behind the scenes that contributes to the development of good horticultural specimens, etc.?
Oh, well, our research component really blends in with everything we do. And one of the things you will see over the next few years is that our research and our 12,000 acres of natural lands are going to become more understood and more involved with the public. We want people to understand that the research we do on these forests, these 80-plus-year-old forests, this beautiful resource that we have, is important. whether it's on the pests invading those forests or invasive species that are invading those forests and your backyard, I might add,
right?
Or whether it's more pure ecological research. I'll give you one example that's very relevant. Bernheim right now is being used by the federal government and the Kentucky Environmental Protection to look at pharmaceuticals in stream water. And what is neat is Bernheim controls much of the watershed for Wilson Creek, and so it's a very clean stream. Mm-hmm. And they're using Bernheim almost as a background point, where they're saying, okay, if this is a clean stream, mm-hmm. how do all the other streams in Kentucky compare? And what's interesting about pharmaceuticals is they go through the water treatment system and they still come into the waterways. And so there are fish and crayfish and other types of organisms that are being affected by these pharmaceuticals in the water. And in fact, one of the big ones is from birth control pills and estrogens. Oh. And we're seeing changes in the sex organs of fish and invertebrates. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very important study, and Bernheim is one of the core elements in that. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of very big studies that occur, and then there's some smaller, really neat things where we're looking at the effects of deer on grazing. We're trying to figure out why there aren't a lot of oak seedlings in eastern forests anymore. And this is something that's being reported from north to south, east to west, is that oak forests are being lost. They're being invaded by beech trees and others. And why? Well, in part because the oak seedlings just aren't surviving. And so what's doing that? Is it deer? Mm-hmm. Is it the lack of fire? Is it, are there other pests, pollution, you know, change in pH? What's going on? And so we're part of an ongoing study to look at those kinds of issues. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of really sure. cool science and research. And in fact, we're in the process of hiring a new director of natural areas and environmental or ecological research at mm-hmm. Bernheim right now.
Yeah, I've always been mystified by, you know, Bernheim's 20 miles south of Louisville, basically, or 25 minutes easily. It's one of the great places in Kentucky. Yet it seems to remain kind of a tough sell in so many ways to get people out there. I mean, do you have any sense of why that is, or why these people just, you know, people love nature. They love to go out and walk in the grass and see the birds and the trees and stuff. And there it all is right there. And you always have to sell it all the time.
But, I mean, have you, in fact, noticed an increase?
Well, I think we've done okay this fall. I mean, I'm happy with our fall numbers. But overall, we're on a trend like many outdoor, and I will say it's not just Bernheim, but many outdoor venues are seeing decreases
really?
Over the last 5 or 8 years.
Huh.
And it's because, well, I mean, you know, some of it's the video games yeah, and
true.
Sports and,
sure.
you know, and all these other distractions
People
that are there.
People are running around doing other things.
Yeah, we're not as outdoor as we used
TV.
To be. And so I think one of the big things is, Bob, that we just aren't top of mind. We're far enough out of town that people don't equate that as being the same as running across town and spending right. 20 minutes to go across town. You know, you could be at Bernheim.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And so we're just a little bit out of people's minds. So one of the things we're doing is like Bloomfest, we're going to bring more reasons for you to be out at Bernheim on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
Our 80th anniversary, we're celebrating July 11th of this year. We're going to have some 80 different things going on at Bernheim, reasons for you
sure.
to come out
Very
and visit.
Good.
You know, we have all kinds of new events coming up. Part of it is also we're going to build new partnerships. Mm-hmm. We're already talking with the Science Center and with the Planetarium and with a lot of other organizations out there mm-hmm. about building visibility for all of us
mm-hmm.
because we need people out there experiencing the outdoors. We need people out there experiencing science and nature.
Sure. Well, and it seems, too, as people become a little bit more conscious of the movement to, you know, not consume all of our natural resources in one foul swoop, right? There's an opportunity, too. You all have a visitor center that is, you know, kind of state of the art in terms of sustainable architectural stuff. How about that for science? But, you know, I mean, there's other reasons for people to kind of get excited about innovation.
Yes.
Bob and I have decided we hate the term green.
Yes.
But that seems like an opportunity for Bernheim to get people to come because people are more interested in those concepts.
Couldn't have said it better myself. And you know, and that really is one of the things. Many people haven't seen our LEED certified visitor center, which has a growing roof and has indoor-outdoor light. It is such a natural, recycled, reused building that you kind of say, why isn't everything built this way? Mm-hmm. And yet it's such a joy to be in and to plan your day at Bernheim. And it also has a great cafe and gift shop as well.
Of course.
A little commercial plug.
You got to have that.
But we also have some fun things coming up. For example, we had a grant that is supporting us, is supporting a program where we built 12 platforms about tabletop height, 12 by 12. And so they mimic what green roofs are, what those growing roofs are about. Mm-hmm. And on those 12 platforms, we're going to test different plants, native plants, glade plants, prairie plants, as well as horticultural varieties that people could use on green growing, living roofs. Uh-huh. And that is such strong program that will be introduced this spring as well.
That sounds exciting. Well, Mark, thank you so much. We appreciate it, and we look forward to seeing what you're going to do at Bernheim.
Thank you. I look forward to speaking with you from time to time.
All right, great. Mark Worms is Bernheim Arboretum's new executive director. His background in botany, ecology, and animal behavior reflect Bernheim's mission of connecting people with nature, and we do indeed look forward to watching Bernheim grow under his direction. No pun intended. Sorry about that. Of course, for more information on Bernheim Arboretum, you can go to our website first at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, listener questions and another chapter in Bob's Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Bob Hill here.
And we've got some questions.
I got one for you.
All right.
It's kind of a funny question. I'm going to leave the questioner anonymous because there could be some lawsuits and family breakups and the usual garden trauma that follows these things. I have a question about my gardenia plant. I kept it inside and I've had it only 6 months. I got it to replace the one I killed last year that a family member gave me. He kept it alive inside and out for 10 years. I didn't want to tell him I let it die, so I've replaced it. Trouble is, this one is starting to go, too. I water it regularly, but the leaves have turned crisp, even though they are green. The soil's always moist, but no standing water. It gets plenty of light, not direct, but all good. I want to keep it alive. It doesn't have to win awards. Just be alive.
Anonymous, right?
Anonymous.
Because it's the replacement. I wouldn't give up, because if the leaves are still green... And it sounds like she's doing everything right. You know, bright light. She's keeping it evenly moist.
Yeah.
Gardenias are going to thrive more outside in the summer with the high relative humidity and bright light. So in the summertime, take it outside, put it in the shade of a tree, and let it, you know, soak in those Kentuckiana summers. Fertilize it from time to time with a formulation for acid-loving plants.
There you go.
That'll help. I think that it's just wintertime indoors with low relative humidity. You're going to get some of that crispy foliage action. Don't despair. Just... it gets ugly by the end of the winter, and then it'll be beautiful by the end of the summer, kind of thing. So
small prayers might help too.
Yeah, and then you know, before you take it out outside in May, or when you take it outside in May, you might need to trim it up a little bit, but that'll incur, as long as the wood is still viable and you can scratch it with your thumbnail a little bit, and if it's still green, as long as the wood's still viable, it will re-leaf. So you just want to make sure that it never completely dries out, because that could, it's a woody plant, so that could make it decline somewhat. But it's wintertime inside.
Plus, we've got her name and number. We're going to call Dad if something goes wrong here.
That's right.
You better do it right, kid.
She's going to try.
Yeah.
All right. Here's another question. This one's from Deborah. She wants to plant a bunch of peonies this spring. What is the best local resource for gorgeous and exotic peonies? Please share any planting and growing tips, and share anything helpful relating to growing peonies in Kentucky. And then she says, or should she order them from an online resource? If so, what nursery? Thank you very much, Deborah.
Well, we collectively wish she'd contacted us last fall when the annual Whitehall peony sale was going on, because That's the wonderful garden off Lexington Road, owned by a friend, or run by a friend of ours, pretty much. And they have an annual peony sale every year out there. And they get peonies from all over the country, some of the very best ones. There's also a Midwest Peony Society she could join.
Mm-hmm.
And get a lot of membership there that can give her some ideas and tips of where to get peonies.
And probably they exchange peonies,
Plus,
too.
Plus, any of the really good gardening nurseries on both sides of the river have peonies for sale in the spring.
Yeah, so she'll just, like, peruse your local garden centers, your specialty garden centers. You know, they're not going to have, like, 100 different choices, but they will have good, reliable, nice peonies for you to start. And then maybe round out planting your collection in the fall of the year by going and purchasing some peonies from Whitehall.
And be prepared to be patient, because peonies are going to take a couple years to really do their thing.
That's right.
If not longer.
And probably the most important planting tip, Bob, is don't plant the eyes that are on the roots, those little pink buds that are on the roots, too deep, no deeper than 2 inches beneath the soil surface, because they have to adequately chill over the winter in order to bloom.
The eyes have it.
The eyes do have it.
If you have a question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org, email us at homegrown@WFPL.org, or call us at 814-8246.
All right, Bob, it's a plant story day. What do you have for us?
One of the hardest working names in the plant business.
Oh, yeah?
Anemone.
Anemone.
It's fun to say.
It is fun to say.
Yeah, it's actually two of my favorite flowers, particularly the ones that come up in the spring, the anemone blanda, for lack of a better name.
It's like a little bulb.
Yeah, it's a tiny little bowl shaped to kind of come in blues and pinks and whites. They pop up in the spring. I had some pop up actually in late January.
Did you?
Early February. You plant them in the fall, of course, and they're known sort of commonly as Grecian windflowers. Mm-hmm. More on that later, but they'll naturalize and reseed, and there's nothing really prettier than a big clump of anemones when you're dying for spring.
Purple, white, and pink, too.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And the totally different one comes up in the fall, the Japanese anemone, or Hupiensis is the Latin on it. It's this tall, elegant flower with those pink and white blossoms that blow in the wind. Mm-hmm. It's a totally different animal than the one in the spring with the same name. It's just one of my favorite fall flowers. And you'd think the name windflower would refer to the larger types, but it doesn't. Most people you hear windflower, the smaller ones.
Mm-hmm.
One theory on that is it comes from the Greek word anemos, which means wind.
Ha, there you go.
The story is that the Greek goddess Flora, as in...
Flora.
As
flower.
In, you got, thank you, Miss Latin person of the week. The Greek goddess Flora was jealous of her husband's attention to the nymph Anemone and transformed her into the west windflower, that was with the mercy of the winds. Yeah. Another was the word anemone was a corruption of the name of the slain god Adonis, which was somehow pronounced Naaman, who was gored to death by a wild boar. Let that be a lesson to you. And his bloody death gave the world the red anemone, the anemone coronaria, which led to an ancient phenomena called the Adonis Gardens. This is cool. In which anemones were planted in clay pots in remembrance. Isn't that neat?
Yeah, it is.
The Japanese anemones also come with a story. They actually came from China. It's true.
Whoops.
Yeah, they were erroneously called Japanese anemones or Anemone japonica after one form was recorded near Hiroshima in 1695, and the name just sort of stuck. As I said, they're a great fall plant. I just love them. I have dozens of them all over the place. This wavy, beautiful flower. Same name, two very diverse plants, one poem. Oh, what should we make of the anemone, a plant well known to you and me, primarily of the spring variety? It pops from the ground, sometimes in snow, telling us spring is good to go, even as we so wish it so. But then that beauty fades away, its message told, hooray, hooray, making way for a brave new day that comes in fall when its cousin returns, taller, more graceful, the stuff of urns, and so the gardener once again learns that there's more to a name than might first appear, two separate plants, yet both bringing cheer at very different times of the year.
Indeed. The anemone.
The anemone.
Very nice. All right, Bob. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. Next week on the show, humane ways to control Canada geese. Yes, it's an issue.
You can't wait
Everybody
for that one,
knows.
Folks. Don't leave your radio.
And hometown girl Kristen Forrest from Jeffersonville originally, but she's a landscape designer in Budapest, and we're going to talk to her while she's home for a couple of weeks.
Visiting the folks.
Yeah.
Homegrown is produced by the rarely windy Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.